All right, I think we are live and on here. There it is on YouTube. So, good evening, everybody. I'm just waiting. There it is on Facebook. Wow, that worked a lot faster than last time. So, let me know if you can hear me. Oh, I can see. See a few people hopping on. I see Debbie's watching, and David and Ann are watching. Tina's watching on the website. Good evening, Debbie. Thanks for joining us. And I think you're the one who makes the treats for Conquer, I believe. And so every week, Bill brings me my bag of treats. So thank you, Debbie. So yes, thanks for tuning in to another Wednesday night. This is week 13. If you're watching, you can let me know in the comments. Say hi, and we'll get started in just a minute here. I'll just wait a minute or so to let people hop on. Yeah, so thank you for tuning in. Like I said, week 13, we are in chapter 17 of the book of Revelation tonight. So we only have six more chapters left in this book. Hello, Lori, and I can see Leah's watching. Thanks for watching. That's awesome. Six more chapters left in this book, so we're kind of nearing the end. And I have really enjoyed walking through this book of the Bible with you. It's been really good, and I've heard from lots of you that it's helped your understanding, and for some of you, it's kind of caused you to dig a little bit deeper into the Word, which is always good. So yeah, that's good. And I heard back from a few people that said, yes, once Revelation is done, let's just keep doing Wednesday night online Bible studies. So whether it's another book of the Bible or something like that, we'll figure that out, but we'll probably just keep going if there is a want and a need for that. So, and Suzanne's watching from the island. That's awesome. Thanks for tuning in. I'm looking forward to whatever you're going to teach us this evening. Awesome. Thank you. So, the book of Revelation, and I hope you don't mind that I just kind of do a few reminders every week just so that we're all on the same page. So, the book of Revelation is an apocalypse, and it's kind of this unveiling of what's really going on. That's really what the word apocalypse means. It's this pulling back of the curtain, so to speak, and it reveals what is going on behind the scenes of world history, and it's kind of like you know, you see things. Oh, I'm waving to people as they walk by. You see things with your senses, right? Here's what's going on in the physical world. In the book of Revelation, it's as if John gets this glimpse, this curtain is pulled back, and then he gets a glimpse into the spiritual realm and what's going on throughout, you know, these scenes of world history. So we've talked about how my approach to the book of Revelation is that it's not solely a book describing a future 7-year literal period right before Jesus comes back. You know, we've talked about how actually, I'd say probably 95% of people that have talked with me about this study that we're doing, they grew up with that kind of left behind. It's very chronological. It's all future. It's all very literal. And what I mean by that, you know, the Bible, we believe the Bible is literally God's word, but they mean literal as in it's not symbolic. It's not metaphor. It's like this is literally chronologically what's going to happen. And then, you know, this happens and then this happens. And then there's a literal mark of the beast on your forehead. And that's what I mean by that. So my approach is that Revelation, because it's an apocalypse, it's actually not meant to be read that way. That's not how you are meant to read apocalyptic literature. And so apocalyptic literature uses images and metaphors and symbols and numbers to describe, yes, a future reality, but it also describes our current reality as well. So we've talked about how there is movement in the book of Revelation. Like we're moving towards the end. We're even going to see that tonight in chapter 17. But it's not linear, and it's not necessarily chronological. If you remember, like many people view, you know, so you have the seals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You've got the trumpets, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then, not the seals again, that's silly. The bowls, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And many people read the book of Revelation as it's just linear, and it's just one thing after another. The seventh seal is opened, and then boom, next up is trumpet number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. When in reality, the book of Revelation uses recapitulation, which means, so we saw that with the seals. It's like John sees the seals and seal number 7. It's kind of bringing us right to the end when Jesus returns. And then it's as if it doubles back on itself. And then you see the same type of things from a different perspective. And so the book of Revelation, sure, it's got movement, but it doubles back on itself. And so it's not necessarily linear and chronological. So I think overall, and this is what I have found super encouraging and super interesting about this book, overall, the message that I think we've seen week to week to week, and it just seems to come up every chapter, the message is a call for faithfulness and endurance. I think we've seen that in almost every chapter. There is, even if it's just one verse, it's like, you know, this is a call for the saints to endure. Even think about last week when we looked at the seven bowls of God's wrath. Even in that, in verse 15, God says, "Behold, I'm coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake." So there is this call to stay awake, to be faithful, to make it until the end. So the book of Revelation, it really is a book of discipleship. For how do we remain faithful to Jesus until he comes back? That's really the main point of the book. So like I said, last week we looked at chapter 16. John has this vision of these seven bowls of God's wrath. And so John sees different angels pouring out bowls of God's wrath. And there was so much imagery that was taken from the story of the Exodus, right? When God sends these 10 plagues on Egypt. And so we see, you know, in these seven bowls, there's so many similarities. There's plagues and there's rivers turning to blood and there's hail and there's frogs and on and on and on. So I read one scholar that said chapter 16 is like, you know, John took all of the plagues of Egypt and put them in a blender and just blew them up to huge proportions, which is kind of what it felt like. So basically, the seven bowls was the point of view from God's throne, right? So I would say the seven seals was the view from the vantage point of the persecuted church. The seven trumpets was the view from the vantage point of the world. And then the seven bowls was the view from the throne of God. And so there was a lot of judgment and heavy things like that in last week's chapter. So tonight we want to study Revelation chapter 17. And most of the headings in your Bible would call this chapter the Great Prostitute and the Beast. So yet again, this is one of those can be confusing chapters of the Bible. There is a lot of imagery and there's a lot of wording used. This is one of the chapters that many, many people have tried to crack the code, so to speak, of, you know, who this is and when this is, and you'll see why as we study it. But I think overall, we're going to see some truths about evil in this chapter. We're going to see, you know, evil's seductive nature, but we're also going to see God's triumph over evil and how evil actually always ends up devouring itself, which is super fascinating. And you'll see that near the end of chapter 17. Hello, Baburam, watching from Nepal. Glad you could join us. Brother, hope your son is doing better. We keep praying for him. Yeah, let us know how we can pray for him. So I want to read, and Jeremiah says, hey, gang, we finally made it back. Awesome. Thanks, Jeremiah, for joining on YouTube. That's great. So I'm going to read Revelation 17, and then we'll just kind of walk through this book together. So starting in verse 1, this is what it says. Then one of the angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. And the angel said to me, the water that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. Wow. super interesting chapter. And I forgot to say it at the beginning, but as we go along, if you do have questions or, you know, comments or things that you want to say or things you want me to clarify, you can just comment in the comment section, and I'll do my best to answer them. But needless to say, super interesting, and there is a ton of imagery in this. So in verses 1-6, we're given this initial description of this woman and this beast. And then later on in verses 7-14, the angel describes what the beast and the images represent. And then at the end, it kind of tells us that evil turns on itself in the end, which is interesting. We'll get to that. So initially, the angel tells John, right? This is one of the seven angels, we're told in verse 1, who had one of those bowls. And he came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters." Now, some people think that chapter 17 is God giving John a more in-depth look into the sixth and the seventh bowl. So if you remember bowl 6 and bowl 7, it was about this big battle that takes place and the final judgment. And so many scholars think that it's as if the angel, you know, they say one of the seven angels in verse 1, they think, okay, this is the seventh angel, and he's showing John, here's a more in-depth look at bowl number 6 and bowl number 7, which I go, yeah, I think that's a pretty good explanation, because there is some crossover, right, in chapter 17. Because in the sixth bowl, it talks about this great battle on the day of the Lord when Jesus returns. And we read about that in chapter 17, this war with the Lamb, and that is when Jesus returns. So chapter 17, it's as if God takes John a little bit deeper into those sixth and seventh bowls, this final judgment. So you're going to notice how fast-moving and changing these symbols are. Even think about the symbol of this woman. We're told in verse 1, she's seated on many waters. Then we're told in verse 2, well, she's seated on the beast. And then we're told in verse 9, she's seated on the mountains. And then in verse 15, we're told, well, no, the water is peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. So it's a very fast-moving image or vision that John has. The woman is seated on the water. No, now she's on the beast. Now she's on the mountains. Now, so there's a lot going on in this chapter. So John then, the angel says to John, I'm going to show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters. And then in verse 2, we're told that the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and the dwellers on earth, and that phrase, right, those who dwell on the earth, we've noticed in the book of Revelation, that refers to unbelievers, those who are not sealed by God. So those who don't follow the Lamb, those are called dwellers on earth, or those who dwell on the earth. It says that they, so unbelievers, became drunk with the wine of her sexual immorality. So it is this image, right, of this seduction, right? This great prostitute, and we're going to read later that it's a city, which is interesting. The end of the chapter says that great prostitute, the woman that you saw, is the great city. So again, metaphors being swapped out. But it's this seductive nature, right? She seduces the kings of the earth. She seduces unbelievers to become drunk on sexual immorality, and so that's what she does. So verse 2, oftentimes in the Bible, false worship, so idolatry, is often compared to sexual immorality, right? If you remember the book of Hosea, for instance, the whole book of Hosea, it's this metaphor of that the people have committed spiritual adultery. So oftentimes in the Bible, the idea of me, for instance, you know, worshiping an idol, that's viewed as spiritual immorality or adultery, or it's compared to sexual immorality, essentially. So I think that verse 2 is referring to the acceptance of the religious and idolatrous demands of the ungodly earthly order, right? So if you remember, I think it's describing those people who worship the beast in chapter 13, right? Those who worship the state, who worship the empire, who worship the government, the political leader of the day, right? That would be the beast. And so I think what we're seeing is is this prostitute, this image of this woman who is seducing people into committing spiritual adultery and idol worship. Now, verse 3, John is carried away into the wilderness. And here he sees a woman sitting on a scarlet beast. And we're told that this scarlet beast is full of blasphemous names and has 7 heads and 10 horns. So this description of the beast is almost identical to the one in chapter 13. So if you flip back to chapter 13, there's this description of a beast, and it says, "I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads and 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads." And so it's the same beast as being described, essentially. And so this is what John sees. He sees the beast from chapter 13, and he sees this woman riding or sitting on the beast. And here's the description of the woman. She's arrayed in purple and scarlet. She's got gold and jewels and pearls. So that's alluding to the fact of being prosperous and wealthy and rich, right? She's dressed in fine clothing. She's holding a golden cup, but we're told that it's full of abominations and impurities. And then written on her forehead is Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And then we're told, John says, he sees the woman and she was drunk, but she's not drunk on wine. She's drunk on the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. So a couple of things. We are told that this vision of a prostitute represents Babylon, right? That's the name that is written on her forehead, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes. So is this a real woman? No, this woman represents Babylon. And so remember, right, and we've seen this a few times, Babylon is, it's almost a code word, for lack of a better term, for any and every nation that is in rebellion against God. Babylon, the history of Babylon goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. That's where Babylon came from. That's where we get the word. And what is the story of the Tower of Babel or Babel? That story is a story of humanity seeking to build a city without God. Right? Hey, we're going to make a name for ourselves, and we're going to build a city that reaches the heavens, right? And we'll never be scattered. So that's the root origin of Babylon. It's human beings together saying, let's build a city without God, right? And then throughout the biblical narrative, Babylon is used as almost an archetype of an evil, wicked nation in rebellion to God. So John, when he says that he is seeing this woman and she's representing Babylon the Great, he's not seeing literally Babylon, right? That nation, at the time when John is having these visions, that nation had been conquered 600 years earlier. So what was the Babylon in John's day? Well, it was Rome, right? Rome was this evil, oppressive nation. And so Rome was Babylon. And you'll see throughout the Bible that Egypt was Babylon, and Nineveh was Babylon, and Rome was Babylon, and Persia and Greece, all of these nations that seek to make a name for themselves and move out from under the authority of God and then begin to blaspheme and claim divinity, they are called Babylon. So all throughout history, we've seen many, many Babylons. And so that's what John is seeing, this woman who represents Babylon the Great. Whether you want to call it, She represents the spirit of Babylon. Maybe that's a way to kind of understand it, right? And what is the spirit of Babylon? Abomination, impurity, blasphemy, sexual immorality, idolatry, that, right? She's holding a cup full of abominations and impurities. That's what Babylon represents. So that's who the woman is. So we're told that, right? The woman is not really a woman. She represents Babylon, any and every nation that is opposed to God. And then we see the beast described in verse 3. I'll just remind you, because we talked about this when we went through chapter 13, but we're told that the beast has 7 heads and 10 horns. Heads represent, or they're a symbol of authority. And horns are a symbol, or they represent strength. And we've talked all along that numbers in the book of Revelation are symbols as well. They mean things, right? When Revelation chapter 5 says that Jesus, John sees a lamb who was slain, who has, you know, 7 horns and 7 eyes. Well, Jesus doesn't literally have that many horns and eyes. I don't think he has any horns. But numbers mean something. So the number 7 is a number of completeness or fullness. And so is the number 10. 10 is also a number of completeness and fullness. And so when you think about John, he sees a vision of a beast who has 7 heads and 10 horns. What that means is he's seeing a picture of evil that has complete or full authority or complete or full strength. Basically, it's a vision of something that is very, very authoritative and very, very strong, right? That's what these heads and horns represent. And so we're told that the beast has great authority and he has great strength. And so the heads and the horns refer to like fullness of power held by evil kingdoms who persecute God's people. And so we're going to get into a little bit more of, because John, the angel tells John later on what the heads and the horns mean. But if you remember, the beast in chapter 13, which is what John is seeing, represented the state, the empire, right, that demanded worship. Right, it represents like an evil state, an evil empire, an evil nation that demands worship, persecutes God's people, blasphemes God. So that's the picture that John gets. So you got to put these pieces together, right? Because imagine seeing this. But what you have is you have Babylon, right? The prevailing economic, religious system, an evil nation and empire, right? You have Babylon represents any nation that is evil and opposed to God. And so you have Babylon in alliance with the state, the beast, and its related authority as it has existed throughout the ages. So what I mean by that is when we would say, Egypt was Babylon, or Rome is Babylon. What we mean is that the beast is operating with the spirit of Babylon, if that makes sense, right? Here's Babylon, the woman, riding on the beast. And so you have this partnership of evil, almost. The woman represents the ungodly world as it works with the state, socially, culturally, and economically, to persecute Christians, right? So the reason that, like I said before, Babylon is pictured as a prostitute is it points to her alluring and seductive nature in actually drawing people away from Christ. If you think about it, even in Revelation chapter 2, when actually Jesus refers to Jezebel, right, in the letter to the church of Thyatira, so many parallels are drawn between this woman, Babylon, and Jezebel. And what does Jesus warn the church, right? You're tolerating this woman, Jezebel, who is seducing my servants to practice sexual immorality and to eat food sacrificed to idols. So same exact issue, right? Babylon is seen as seducing people to worship the beast, to worship idols. And even in Revelation chapter 2, Jezebel is seen as seducing people, people getting drunk. That's the image, right? Getting drunk from her and committing sexual immorality. So that's this first vision that John sees. The reason that she has a name on her forehead, we've seen that a few times already, right? A name on a forehead reveals an individual's character and his or her relationship either to God or to Satan, right? We're told that followers of the Lamb have his name written on their forehead. That was Revelation chapter 14. Now, if you're a follower of Jesus, you don't literally have Jesus written on your forehead, but it means that you are identified. Your ideology, your thinking, you are identified with the Lamb. And then we're told in Revelation chapter 13 that those people who worship the beast will take the mark of the beast on their forehead. Now, that doesn't literally mean that you're going to have 666 written on your forehead. What it means is that your ideology, your thinking, your worship, you're identified with Satan, right? And so the same is here. We're told that this woman, Babylon, has her name. And what is her name? It's awful. Mother of prostitutes, of earth's abomination. That represents who Babylon is, what Babylon is about. So, that is this first picture of the woman and the beast. And we're told in John 6 that we're told in verse 6, that John marvels greatly at this. And I kind of go, well, yeah, no kidding. That must have been unbelievable to see. I don't know if some of you saw the artwork that I posted on the church Facebook page, but that was someone's artistic rendering of what this might have looked like. But John marvels greatly at this. And I love that in verse 7, the angel says, "Why do you marvel?" Right? He's just so, what's so marvelous about this, John? Why do you marvel? And then he says, "I will tell you the mystery of this woman and of the beast with seven heads and 10 horns that carries her." He says, "I'm going to tell you the mystery of this." And what is the mystery? I think that part of the mystery is the angel is going to describe a little bit of what these symbols mean. But I think, too, the mystery is, we're going to see at the end of the chapter, the mystery refers to the ironic, mysterious ways that God is going to fulfill his prophetic words concerning Babylon's destruction. I think that's part of the mystery, right? That God is actually going to use evil to turn on itself to accomplish God's own purposes. I think that is part of the mystery that this angel is talking about. So, verse 8, the angel is now going to unpack this vision of the beast. So, this is where it gets good. He says in verse 8, "The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction." So, we're told that the beast was, is not, and is about to go to destruction. Or he says he's going to rise from the bottomless pit to go to destruction. So think about what is that similar to? If you think about God, right? And we've seen this a few times. God is talked about who was and who is to come, right? So yet again, we have this parody of God. And we saw that in chapter 13. Satan and Beast 1 and Beast 2 are meant to be a parody of the Trinity. It's as if evil is setting up an unholy Trinity to mock and parody God. And so much of the language in chapter 13 was evil mocking God. So, you know, the beast gets a mortal wound, but yet he comes back to life. And that's a mockery of Jesus' death and resurrection, and on and on and on. And so even here, this is meant to be, this is a parody of God. God is the one who was and who is to come. And the beast is described as the one who was and is not, and who is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. So when the angel says that the beast is not, what he means by that is that the beast has already been defeated at the cross of Christ, even though the beast lives on until the return of Jesus. He's not, right? God was and is. He is ruling and reigning, and he's sovereign, and he is. And what the angel is saying, the beast is not. Even though the beast is still causing havoc and persecuting the church, well, he's not. He's already been defeated through the death and resurrection of Jesus, even though he lives on. And about to rise is meant to be a parody of the resurrection and the second coming. But what does the beast rise to? The beast rises to destruction, right? Which will happen when Jesus returns. Now, the rest of verse 8 talks about the dwellers on earth. And again, we talked about that. That represents unbelievers. That's a phrase used to describe. It doesn't mean literally anyone that dwells on the earth. Dwellers on earth means unbelievers, those who don't worship the Lamb. And we're told that because it says in verse 8, their names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. So these are unbelievers. And it says that they marvel to see the beast because it was and is not and is to come. And so it's kind of similar to Revelation chapter 13, where the dwellers on the earth worship the beast, right? They don't worship the Lamb, they worship the beast. And so if you remember the beast from chapter 13, the first beast represents political powers that claim divinity and demand worship. So it would be representative of empires, nations, political powers that blaspheme God and persecute his people. That would be the first beast. And the second beast in chapter 13 is religious and economic structures that are intended to push people to worship the first beast, which is the state or the empire, right? So what we learned about the beast in chapter 13 is behind any nation that would blaspheme God, claim divinity, and persecute Christians, behind that nation is the beast operating, right? And then any nation that does that and then has religious or economic structures that then push people to worship the state, that would be the second beast operating in a nation. So just to remind you of what these beasts are, I don't think that the beast is a literal one guy, right? We talk a lot about the Antichrist, even though the word Antichrist appears nowhere in the book of Revelation. We think that it's this one guy near the end who's going to deceive the whole world. I think chapter 13 is describing any and every nation that blasphemes God, persecutes Christians, sets up idolatry. That would be the beasts working behind the scenes. So then in verse 9, the angel says, this calls for a mind with wisdom. So, do you have a mind with wisdom? Because the angel says, you're going to need one. This calls for a mind with wisdom. And now he's going to give us what some of these things represent. So he says, this calls for a mind with wisdom. And he says, the seven heads are seven mountains. So you go, okay. It's not really helpful. And so he says, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. So, right, she's not seated on the waters anymore. She's seated on the mountains. And then it says, they are also seven kings. So, wrap your mind around that. The seven heads on the beast, we're told, are seven mountains, and they're also seven kings. And then, this is where it gets really interesting. He says, five have fallen. One, I believe it says one is, and one, sorry, I lost my place. The other has not yet come. Not yet come. Okay, so the seven heads are seven mountains. They're also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, and the other has yet to come. And when he does, he must remain only a little while. So isn't that a head scratcher? So there's been a couple of ways to interpret who is the angel talking about. Like, what is John seeing here? And like I said, much has been written about trying to crack the code of who this is. And usually, it's in an attempt to kind of pinpoint the Antichrist, right? Five have fallen, one is that one. And it's trying to, like, you know, pin the tail on the Antichrist. Who is it? When is it going to take place? So there's a few different ways that verses 9 to 11 are viewed. Some have viewed it as John is seeing the empire of Rome being described here for a couple of reasons. One, Rome was built on seven mountains. So some people have said, you know, the seven heads are seven mountains. So John is seeing the nation of Rome. And if you're curious, the seven mountains, I found this interesting. I actually didn't know that, but they were called Palatine, Capitoline, Aretine, Caelian, Aquiline, Viminal, and Quirinal. Those are the seven mountains that Rome was actually built on. And so it's led some to say, well, John is just seeing a vision of Rome. This is his reality that he's living in right now. And then they've gone to go, okay, so five kings have fallen, one is, and one has not yet come. And so much has been written about, okay, well, this is talking about five emperors from Rome that have already died, and one that is. So this would be, in many people's mind, well, the emperor that was, while John was seeing this vision, was Domitian. So they would say, well, he's the one who is. He's the emperor that's reigning right now. And then there's one who's not yet come. But there's some problems with that, right? And I won't write them all down, but you have the list of emperors for Rome. You have Julius Caesar, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, Galba, Otho, Vitellius, Vespasian, Titus, then Domitian, and then Nerva. And so Nerva would come after. But here's what's interesting. If this is only describing Rome, it's kind of anticlimactic. Because, right, one who's not yet to come, and he remains only a little while, and then it's like, and then it seems like then it's the end, right? And then Jesus comes, da 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 da. But that didn't happen, right? After Domitian, there wasn't one more Roman emperor, and then everything ended. So, and then even the five that have fallen, there has been much debate about, well, which five former emperors is this talking about? Because there was a few emperors like Otho and Vitellius that ruled for less than a year. So do they count as like great kings when they were overturned so fast? And so when you do that, what happens is you're left trying to make the wording of verses 9 to 11 fit into the history of Rome's emperors. And so it doesn't quite line up really well. So the other historic view, so that's one view, right? John is just seeing a vision of Rome. That's it. The other historic view is, well, maybe this refers to seven empires that have oppressed God's people. And so some people have said, well, I don't know if you can see this far over. I think so. Maybe it's Egypt, right? That would be one. Assyria. Then Babylon, then Persia, then Greece, then the one that is would be Rome when John is writing. And then they would say, well, there's still some future nation that's yet to come, like an end times world superpower. Right, some have talked about, you know, at the end there's going to be a one world government. Maybe that's what this is, and so that is another historic view, that the seventh nation that or the seventh king that hasn't come yet and only rules for a little while. Maybe that's some future empire that's yet to come. So those are two historic ways, right? Or the way that I think is best is, like much of the rest of Revelation, perhaps this is meant to be symbolic. So again, think about what does the number seven represent, right? The number seven refers to completeness or fullness. And so I think what we're seeing is the number seven, when it's referring to the beast, is the fullness of oppressive power. Right, the fullness or the completeness of evil. And so I think perhaps the seven mountains and the seven kings represent the oppressive power of world government throughout the ages. Right, so the seven heads of the beast is just the totality of blasphemy and evil. So again, like in other places in the book, maybe seven is not a quantitative measure, but it refers to like qualitative fullness. Maybe we're not really meant to go, okay, five and one and one. Maybe the seven heads, so I'll give you why I think this. Mountains, and the Greek word for mountain here is oros, carries a figurative meaning in the Old Testament to refer to strength. Mountains in the Old Testament often were symbolic of human or divine kingdoms. So I'll give you a few examples. Isaiah 2, verse 2. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains. Jeremiah 51, 25. Behold, I am against you, O destroying mountain, declares the Lord. Declares the Lord, which destroys the whole earth. And in Jeremiah 51, Jeremiah is prophesying against Babylon. And yet God says, I'm against you, O destroying mountain, which is super interesting. Ezekiel 35:3, thus says the Lord God, behold, I'm against you, Mount Seir, and I will stretch out my hand against you, and I will make you a desolation and a waste. And then in Zechariah 4:7, who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you shall become a plain. So lots of times in the Old Testament, mountains are used figuratively to symbolize kingdoms. And so I think that when the angel says, you know, the seven heads are seven mountains and they're also seven kings, I don't think we're meant to view them as like separate things. All we're meant to view them as the seven heads, the heads which symbolize authority, mountains symbolize strength, and then kings are often, obviously, pictures of authority and rule and power. And so I think what John is saying is this represents the oppressive power of world governments throughout the ages that claim divinity and persecute God's people. So in John's day, for instance, the contemporary embodiment of the beast was Rome. Rome was the beast. Rome is Babylon. Rome is, you know, one of these mountains, one of these kings, right? And so remember, like, Revelation often mixes metaphors and symbols and images, and they all are kind of pointing to a similar thing. So at that time, what is Rome? Well, Rome is one of these heads. Rome is one of these mountains. Rome is one of these kings, and it's Babylon, right? It's all of these things oppressing God's people. I think the fact that the angel says five have fallen, I think that just is meant to show us that many governments have come and gone, right? Don't get caught up on, you know, five and one, that you have to crack the code about which ones they are. All I think that the angel is saying is that many governments have come and gone. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, whatever. Even today, right, as nations rise and fall, nations fall all the time. The one who is, right, I think that just means the present activity of the beast in any generation. In John's time, it was Rome. That was the one who is. And then the seventh has not yet come. And when he does, it's only for a little while. And so I think, yes, that is pointing to some future manifestation of the beast, right, and Babylon, before Jesus returns. I remember someone asked me, do you think there's going to be one last, you know, evil empire that rises? And there very well could be. And perhaps that's what this one is talking about, this last evil nation that rises right before Jesus comes back. That very well could be. Now, here's what I find interesting. And please, if you have questions, you can comment. I always get slightly worried when it's quiet, if people are going, what on earth is he talking about? Here's what's interesting. So the angel gives John some explanation, right? And what I think he's doing, like I said, is he's giving a picture of oppressive world governments throughout the ages, right, that have strength and power and authority as they persecute God's people. But then what he says in verse 11, it's so interesting. He says, as for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven. And it goes to destruction. So you have, like, wrap your minds around this, right? Because here's the symbolic apocalyptic nature of Revelation. You have five nations fallen, one who is, one who's not yet to come. And then he says, and there's an eighth, and that's the beast, but it belongs, right, to the seven. So you kind of go, what is he talking about? Here's what he means. Literally, when it says that it's an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, What it means, literally, that means it is of the seven. So the beast is the power behind all of these governments and empires and blasphemous rulers who have oppressed God's people throughout history, right? He's saying, here's a picture, these seven kings, seven mountains. This is a picture of oppressive, authoritative governments that persecute God's people. And then he says, the beast is an eighth, but he's of the seven, meaning he's the one behind these oppressive, evil, authoritative governments. So I think that means that the manifestation of the dragon and the beast through earthly kings is like the full presence of the dragon or the beast himself. Right? So what I'm getting at is, like, right, you would look at the nation of Babylon, let's say, for example, the historical nation of Babylon, who oppressed God's people, were blasphemous, and you would say, was that the beast and the dragon? And the fact that the angel says the eighth beast is of the other seven, then yes, it's a guarantee. Any nation that is evil and blasphemous and persecutes God's people is of the beast, right? The beast is what is operating behind the scenes of that. Does that make sense? I hope that's as clear as I can make it. I don't think that we're meant to sit around and wonder, you know, and crack the code about who this is. I think this is just giving us a picture of all oppressive and authoritative governments which have the beast working behind the scenes, right? Because remember, Revelation, we're pulling we're pulling back the veil. Dawn and Joy ask, why does all of Revelation have to be so coded? Why can't it just be stated clearly and plainly? Yeah, right? That'd be a lot easier. I actually read one scholar that thought one of the reasons that John wrote, or the book of Revelation was written in this apocalyptic way, was, if you remember, John is an exile, a prisoner, in Rome, and so he's writing a letter that then would be delivered to these seven churches. So some scholars have said perhaps John received this vision and wrote an apocalypse, because if he was super straightforward and straight and plain, the nation of Rome, or like the guards or whatever, probably wouldn't have let him send that, right? If he's saying, hey, Rome is evil, don't worship Rome, they would probably be like, no, we're not going to let you send that. I read one scholar that said they probably thought this was just nonsensical ramblings of an old man, right? And so they said, sure, you can mail this to the seven, your seven churches that you want to mail this to. This doesn't make any sense. So I don't know if that's true, but I thought that was interesting, that maybe that's why it is so coded. I think another reason perhaps is, if it was stated clearly and plainly, right, if you're thinking about what's going on behind the scenes, I think, one, John probably was trying to in some way communicate what he was seeing. I can't imagine seeing what John saw. And so probably that's why some of it is just very confusing, because he's trying to write down all of these spiritual things that he's seeing, and trying to put words to it. But also, I think on one hand, it helps us live with a little bit of the mystery, right? And that's why I really struggle with the chronological, straightforward, boom, 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 this is how everything ends, because I don't think we're meant to actually know that. I think we're actually meant to live with a little bit of mystery in when Jesus is coming back. And the whole point is that we would just be faithful till the end. Ramesh asks, do you think it would be India or China? Right? When he I think you're talking about the one that's not yet to come. Yeah, to be honest, I really don't know. right? And I've heard people that have said, yes, that last, you know, nation that rises up, that's got to be China. Or it's got to be, you know, I remember people talking that it was Russia or whatever. And I don't know. And part of me goes, I don't know if it's necessarily important to pinpoint what is this last nation before Jesus comes back. Because again, you'll see over and over and over again, the whole point of Revelation is it's saying, regardless of what nation you live in, just be faithful to the Lamb, right? Just endure till the end. Don't worship anything or anyone besides Jesus. So I don't, it could be India, could be China, could be, I don't know. But I think the main thing is that whatever it is, right, and whatever country or nation you live in, don't worship the beast, right? Worship Jesus alone. So verse 12, hopefully some of that makes sense. Verse 12, it's like, here's another, you know, doozy. The 10 horns, right? So remember, the beast has 7 heads and 10 horns. So we're told that the 7 heads are 7 mountains and they are 7 kings. But then in verse 12, it says, the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. The historic view is that these are 10 literal kings or rulers, right? Some have said maybe it was talking about 10 Roman provinces, or maybe it's talking about 10 future nations. But again, I think 10 is the number of completeness as well. So this could mean it represents the any and all kings, the totality of the powers of all the nations on earth, which are going to align themselves with the beast. So I think it very well could be referring to future kings. And by that, I mean future empires and nations that are going to blaspheme God and persecute God's people. And it's almost, the way it's described, it's like it's this concentration of universal power in the very last days, right, before Jesus returns. So I think when it's talking about 10 kings who haven't received power yet, I think what it's talking about is this complete totality of these nations on earth, which at the very end are going to align themselves with Satan before Jesus returns. And the reason I say that is the very next verse says, they're of one mind, and they give power and authority to the beast. They make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. So just like the in chapter 16, the seventh bowl brings us right up to, boom, then Jesus returns and judgment happens in the end. I think we're being brought right up to the end again, right? So these 10 kings, I think, are representative of any and all nations at the very end who are going to go with Satan and oppose the return of Jesus, because then we have this battle that's described. And I love that it says they make war on the Lamb, and then, Don says, can't ask because the website's down. Is it still down, Don? Hopefully it's not. So it says that they make war on the Lamb, and then the Lamb conquers them. And I love that the Lamb conquers them simply by showing up. Right? He conquers them. Why? Because he's Lord of Lords and King of Kings. It doesn't say that Jesus conquers them because he uses superior battle tactics or blah, 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 blah. Jesus conquers them just because he shows up, right? And he's King of Kings and he's Lord of Lords. And those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. So one of the reasons I think verses 12 to 14 could be describing the return of Jesus and this final kind of amalgamation of evil is the word hour, right? It says in verse 12 that these kings have authority for 1 hour together with the beast. Now, here's what's super interesting. The word hour is hora. I think there's a little like thingy over the O. Hora. And that word is used in the book of Daniel really uniquely in all of the Old Testament to refer to the final eschatological hour where saints are persecuted, forces of evil are destroyed, and saints are rewarded. So the word hour that is used, it refers to literally like the final moment of history before Jesus returns. So I think that's why we're seeing this kind of final battle, perhaps, is that these 10 kings, I think that's representative of the completeness of any and all nations who worship the beast and oppose Jesus. It's like they're given authority for 1 hour at the very end, and then Jesus returns and they're conquered. Now, the very last three verses, and hopefully the website's still working. I know Don texted me. I'm gonna text him. Does it work? Is the website working? So hopefully it is, and you can still see me, Don. The last three verses are really fascinating. We're gonna see that at the end of history, God is going to inspire the state and its allies to turn against the economic and religious system in order to remove its security and destroy it. So what I mean by that is God at the very end is going to actually cause evil to collapse in on itself, which is just, it's amazing, right? It's pictured as evil turning in on itself in like a civil war type of way. And what's fascinating is that even Jesus talked about this in Mark chapter 3, verse 26. Jesus, he's talking about, you know, conquering Satan. Okay, so people are saying the website works. Okay, so I don't know, Don, what you're saying. Maybe your TV doesn't work. But in Mark 3, verse 26, Jesus says, "If a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but is coming to an end." And that's exactly what we see in verses 15 to 18 of chapter 17. We see evil turning in on itself, and God is the one that causes that to happen. So John is told in verse 15 that the beast, the prostitute, which is Babylon, is seated, and she's seated on peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. So again, I think that's just representing any and all nations that are evil. There's Babylon. But then it says this, the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute, and they'll make her desolate and naked, and they'll devour her flesh, they'll burn her up with fire. And we ask, well, why? Why would they? There's this great partnership of evil, right? You have Babylon, which is the ungodly world, and you have the beast, which is working behind the scenes to persecute God's people and draw people away from Jesus. And then it says that then the beast and the horn turn on the prostitute. And it says this in verse 17, "For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over the royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled." So God, again, it's so encouraging because God is sovereign over all of this that's happening, right? God puts this into their hearts, these nations, to turn on each other, to turn evil collapsing in on itself. And it says that God did that to actually carry out his purposes. So again, God is sovereignly in control of everything. And the imagery of the ten horns and the beast destroying the harlot, they're actually taken from Ezekiel chapter 23 and Ezekiel chapter 16. So Ezekiel chapter 23, starting in verse 25, there's some similar language. I will direct my jealousy against you that they may deal with you in fury. They shall cut off your nose and your ears, and your survivors shall fall by the sword. They shall seize your sons and your daughters, and your survivors shall be devoured by fire. They shall also strip you of your clothes and take away your beautiful jewels. Thus I will put an end to your lewdness and your whoring begun in the land of Egypt, so that you shall not lift up your eyes to them or remember Egypt anymore. So that is describing in Ezekiel what Babylon was going to do to Israel. And so now you have, at the very end of history, it's almost this reversal, right? Now what Babylon did to Israel, it's being applied to the Babylonian world system, that it's going to collapse in on itself. So it's so encouraging on one hand, right? On one hand, you read that and you go, yeah, when before Jesus returns, it's going to get worse, right? Because nations that are evil and worship the beast and follow Satan are going to rise up and they're going to persecute God's people. So it is going to get worse, right? We don't want to be naive, but it's so encouraging that God is firmly in control, and at the end, he will make evil turn on itself. And I love the picture that Jesus shows up, right? It's like these nations are gathered together. We're going to make war on the Lamb. We hate Jesus. We hate his church. And Jesus shows up and he conquers them. And how does he conquer them? Just by showing up. Isn't that amazing? Because he's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So on one hand, it's incredibly encouraging, right? Right? We remain faithful to the end. And even if we die, right, we win. Even in our death, we win. And then Jesus shows up and evil collapses in on itself and Jesus conquers them. So, I mean, we know the end of the story, and the end of the story is that Jesus wins, which is super encouraging. Before we end, I want you to notice that in the book of Revelation, there's some very intentional comparisons being made. And we've seen it a few times, but there's a very intentional contrast being made between Babylon and Jerusalem, right? It's this contrast being made between the city of God versus the city that is opposed to God, right? And there's this contrast between the bride of Christ and the Babylonian harlot. Because even, like, so you have the bride of Christ, which is called the city of Jerusalem, the New Jerusalem. And then you have the prostitute, which is called Babylon. And what you have is this picture of these two cities, these two women, right? The bride of Christ, Jerusalem, and the prostitute, Babylon. And what you have in the book of Revelation is these two pictures between the first and second comings of Jesus. And it's as if the book of Revelation is asking, okay, where do you land, right? Are you following this way? Are you following the Lamb? Are you a part of the bride of Christ? Are you in the New Jerusalem? Or are you following the beast? Are you following the prostitute, right? Are you a part of Babylon? One is pictured as this pure bride, and then one is pictured as an impure harlot. And even the language that introduces both of them is identical. In chapter 17, verse 1, the angel says to John, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters." In Revelation 21, it says this, "One of the angels who had the seven bowls said to me, 'Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb.'" Identical phrase, right? Same angel says to John, "Come, I'm going to show you the prostitute, Babylon." And that same angel, in a few chapters we're going to see, is going to say to John, come, I want to show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Both the bride and the harlot are adorned with costly jewels. The harlot is adorned to hide her inner corruption, and the bride is adorned to reveal God's glory. Each of them is seen in a desert. Isn't that fascinating? Right? John is carried away into the wilderness, and in chapter 12, what happened? The woman was carried off into the wilderness, representing the people of God. And then both are referred to as cities, right? In Revelation 17:18, it says this prostitute is the great city. And in Revelation 21, verse 2, it says, the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven, prepared as a bride, right? So, again, the book of Revelation is just beautiful in how it's written. It's confusing, right, at times, but it's beautiful in how it's comparing these two things. Do you want to follow the world system, Babylon, the harlot, or do you want to follow the Lamb, right, the bride of Christ? Do you want to be a part of this new Jerusalem? So be encouraged. Kevin asked, where's the clock? So usually there's a clock here. I completely broke it. I was going to like grab one of my books and I knocked the clock off and the fingers of the clock fell off and the back of it broke. So no more clock. So be encouraged that even if it gets worse, right? And it will. The world will get worse. Right? But be encouraged to remain faithful to Jesus, right? Even to the point of death, to remain faithful to Jesus. And the hope that we cling on to is that even when the world seems to be spiraling and evil seems to be winning, we hold on to the fact that Jesus is going to show up one day and come, Lord Jesus, right? Amen. Please come, Jesus. And Jesus is going to come one day, and evil is going to explode or implode on itself, and Jesus is going to conquer it, and then we get to be with him forever. So be encouraged. And what's amazing about the rest of the book is, I mean, we've slugged through a lot of heavy stuff, but the rest of the book, it's like describing just victory after victory for Jesus. It just gets really, really good. So, five more chapters now, and then we'll be done. So that's it for tonight. I'll just wait a minute. If there's any last questions or comments, I want to make sure that you get them in. I'll upload this tomorrow to the website, and I'll put my notes in PDF form on the website as well so that you can download them. Tina says, it's so encouraging and exciting. Thanks, Angie. You're welcome. Yeah, I agree. So, If you have a specific book of the Bible that you want to study, I know David said we should study Genesis after this, but if you have a specific book of the Bible that maybe you want to study after this, you can text me or let me know. We do have probably, you know, five more weeks at least, and then we'll be done, but hopefully you're encouraged and you're strengthened. I know that especially during this time when we can't necessarily meet in person all together, I hope that stuff like this just puts, you know, iron in your bones and strengthens you. And I have no doubt that in a very short amount of time, we'll be meeting together again. And it's going to be so good. So thanks for tuning in, and God bless you. And we'll talk to you next week.